Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. Throughout the last phase of that war, the so-called Cold War, and this, there has been a man of uncommon integrity, deep knowledge, and clarity with respect to his illuminating, particularly a challenge to freedom in this ongoing struggle, this existential struggle, if you will, for freedom, and that is David Satter. These days, he is a senior fellow at the Hudson Institute, but he has been a superb reporter deep behind enemy lines through much of his career for organizations like the Financial Times. And he is the author of numerous extraordinarily important books, including the new one, The Less You Know, The Better You Sleep, Russia's Road to Terror, and Dictatorship Under Yeltsin and Putin. David Satter, welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. It's a delight to have you with us.
Thank you, Frank.
You have done incredibly important investigative work and, as I say, courageous reporting on how Vladimir Putin came to power. Would you share with us what you've learned, what we still don't know, and what we should make of it?
Well, I think that the 1999 apartment bombings, which were described afterwards as Russia's 9/11, although they took place in 1999, in which 300 people were killed while they slept, was a provocation. I don't think it was carried out. I think the evidence makes it clear. It was not carried out by Chechen rebels. It was carried out by the Russian secret services themselves in order to create a pretext for a new war in Chechnya that would elevate Putin to power.
And in fact, as an old KGB man himself, Putin would have understood the opportunities available to him through this kind of tradecraft. It kind of harkens back to the Hitlerian Reichstag fire, and more recently, I think the coup in Turkey. That this is a practiced technique of totalitarians or aspiring totalitarians to gain prominence and gain public support. One of the telltale signs as to who was responsible, as you know, David Satter, was someone who was caught in flagrante, as it were, in the act of trying to blow something up. Talk about that, if you would.
Well, this is it. Many people have dismissed the evidence about what happened as a conspiracy theory, but it's no conspiracy theory. I mean, it's an incontrovertible fact that FSB agents were arrested after placing a bomb, and after being seen placing a bomb in the basement of a building in the city of Ryazan, southeast of Moscow. And the FSB later said it was only a training exercise. The bomb was tested, and it tested positive for hexagon. The explosive that was used in the previous four apartment bombings.
Yeah. So Putin, let's just stipulate here, was implicated in these attacks, used it to vault to power, and ultimately supplanted Boris Yeltsin. What has Putin been doing ever since, David Satter, that suggests that this was not sort of an anomalous activity on his part, but really a manifestation of the kind of thug he is?
Well, it's exactly what you could expect from the KGB. Now they call themselves the FSB, but it's the same mentality and the same moral standards.
And many of the same people, in fact.
Some of the same people, although, as the years have gone by, there's been turnover, of course.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. But the we have other examples. We have the hostage taking in the theater on Dubrovka in 2002, the Beslan school massacre, in which children and parents were fired on with flamethrowers and grenade launchers, supposedly in an effort to destroy the terrorists, but in fact to destroy absolutely everything, including the evidence, because there was plenty of evidence that this was a provocation organized in part by the Russian secret services. The war in Ukraine itself is a provocation, because the claim that Russian forces or that separatist forces backed by Russia are defending Russian speakers and the rights of Russian speakers, people supposedly subjected to persecution, is nonsense. There is no persecution of Russian speakers in Ukraine.
David, there has been most recently this claim by Vladimir Putin and his friends that Ukrainian forces have attacked across the border into Crimea. Is there any evidence that this is other than another Russian provocation as well?
It sounds very much like a Russian provocation, and this is typical. I mean, this is how the Second World War started, when the Germans claimed the Poles had crossed over and blown something up, and that was the trigger for launching an invasion. So, although from this distance, it's difficult to be absolutely sure without a thorough investigation. Everything indicates that it's a problem.
It fits the profile, other words.
It's something that's been made up. And that's what the Ukrainians are saying.
That is what they're saying. And it would certainly serve Vladimir Putin's purposes if he had some new pretext for operating against the Ukrainians. And there is reason to believe, according to NATO, that he's preparing to do just that. David, let me just segue quickly, because there's so much more to talk about, but we're almost out of time. I did want to ask you this question. In light of all of this, in light of how Putin came to power, what he's done with power, not just with respect to these acts of aggression, but violating treaties, barbarously violating human rights in his own country, among other places, how would you recommend American voters, on the one hand, and those who would be our next commander-in-chief, view Putin? Is he, as Hillary Clinton once thought, a partner for a reset? Is he, as Donald Trump seems to think, a potential ally? What do you recommend?
Well, I think that everyone should go back to the story of the apartment bombings and ask themselves what kind of person is ready to come to power by committing a terrorist act against his own people. That will answer all your questions. Once you understand who he is and who you're dealing with, you realize this is not an ally. This is not someone with whom there can be a reset, someone who has to be deterred. He has to be deterred. And one of the factors in deterrence is always psychological deterrence. Deterrence is in part convincing your adversary that you know who he is and you'll react appropriately to his action.
Do you anticipate in the days ahead, including quite possibly the period between now and the election, or at least the inauguration of our next president, that we will see Vladimir Putin trying to fill still more vacuums of power, David Satter, as he seems to be doing for the moment, among other places in Iran, for example, and attacks from there against Syria?
I don't think it will depend necessarily on our election. I think it will depend on the internal dynamics in Russia itself, because all of this that's taking place is an attempt to strengthen the hold on power of a small group that has been able to seize property and the instruments of violence in Russia. And if they feel that that's threatened, they know the best way to unite the people around them instead of against them is some type of foreign adventure. And I think that's what's behind this. But of course, it's insofar as their position is inherently unstable because of their own misrule, we can expect problems at any time, including up until the election.
And miscalculations to boot. David Satter, I appreciate so much your time today, the work you do at the Hudson Institute, as well as the Foreign Policy Research Institute in Philadelphia, and my alma mater, the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies. Congratulations on your new book, which we'd love to have you back for a much, much more in-depth conversation about The Less You Know, The Better You Sleep: Russia's Road to Terror and Dictatorship Under Yeltsin and Putin. We'll talk with you again soon, my friend. Best of luck. Next up, Fred Flights joins us from the Center for Security Policy on politicization of intelligence and more straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
Over the past decade, while the American military and intelligence community have been engaged in a kinetic war overseas against a wide array of enemies aligned with the global jihadist movement, the Center for Security Policy has consistently shed light upon a dark and subversive effort that thrives nearly unopposed right here in this country, the one known by the Muslim Brotherhood as Civilization Jihad. In an effort to educate freedom-loving Americans about Civilization Jihad and how it has been waged against every facet of American civilization, the Center for Security Policy has, in 2015, begun publishing a series of monographs called the Civilization Jihad Reader Series. The first of these monographs is entitled Sharia in American Courts, and it documents how Sharia, divine Islamic law, which animates the global jihadist movement, has entered our very own court system. In this study, the Center documents how parties to litigation in American appellate courts have attempted to use Sharia to resolve 146 cases in 32 different states, potentially threatening the constitutional rights of our citizens, particularly women and children. The monograph not only highlights these cases, but the organizations here in America that are actively and successfully working to insinuate Sharia into our judiciary. Finally, it provides information on at least one antidote to this infirmity, a law that has been adopted in 8 states. One that protects our citizens against the use of foreign law and upholds our Constitution as the supreme law of the land, lest those who fight to defend our Constitution overseas do not come home to see it subordinated in a courtroom in their own home state. Learn more by reading Sharia in American Courts, which can be found on Amazon.com or the Center for Security Policy's website at www.securefreedom.org.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real Special Forces, ours need ammunition. And in the war of ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
I'm Jared Ogden, former Navy SEAL and member of Team Military on National Geographic Channel's Ultimate Survival Alaska. I want to tell you about an issue that you probably haven't heard much about. Thousands of America's veterans are suffering from occupational and environmental exposures that they were exposed to while serving in the military. We call these the toxic wounds of war. From Agent Orange and Gulf War illness to post-9/11 burn pit exposure and heavy metals in the air, and other toxic exposures that we don't fully understand. The Sergeant Sullivan Center is a powerful voice in our nation's capital, standing watch over these forgotten wounded. These men and women can't do it alone, and they need your help today. Every dollar raised by Sergeant Sullivan Center goes to medical research, public awareness, and advocacy. You can make a tax-deductible donation today at www.sergeantsullivancenter.org. That's SGTSullivanCenter.org.
This is Frank Effney. You're listening to AM 1260, The Answer.
You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back, joined by my colleague at the Center for Security Policy, Fred Flights, a career intelligence professional of great renown and great contributions, as a matter of fact, both for about 20 years at the Central Intelligence Agency as an analyst specializing in the rogue states and their nonproliferation violations and ambitions. His work as the chief of staff to Ambassador John Bolton at the State Department, and not least his service as a member of the professional staff of the Intelligence Committee in the House of Representatives, have all qualified him greatly for his present role as the Senior Vice President for Policy and Programs at the Center for Security Policy. Fred Flights, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Good to be here, Frank.
Fred, you are as ever prolific on so many different fronts. One that really caught my eye was National Review Online today about the politicization of intelligence that is now much in evidence in connection with Donald Trump's being briefed by intelligence officers. But this is a subject that you've dealt with for a long time, both inside the belly of the beast and from the outside now. Talk a bit about the problem and how it has manifested itself in the past and its implications for today.
Well, it's an interesting story. Mr. Trump has been criticized for saying he doesn't trust the U.S. intelligence community and he's skeptical about their analysis. But I know from my 25-year career, there have been problems with really profound bias within the agency, at least dating back to Reagan. And my research shows it goes back far, much, much beyond that. And we remember during the George W. Bush administration, efforts to undermine his counterterrorism policies with constant leaks. In fact, I mentioned my NRO piece that the Wall Street Journal ran an op-ed called the CIA insurgency because the efforts in 2004, the leaking against him was so bad and seemed so obvious to try to undermine Bush's reelection.
And to the extent that this problem has not only crossed the line from the business of intelligence, but into the business of politics really is a transgression of a very serious concern, both with respect to the job that the intelligence community is supposed to do and the interference that it can have in the political business. Fred, when you've seen this slop over of intelligence professionals engaging in, interference with not just the policymaking business, but even our political affairs, as someone who has been in that business yourself, I know this is an affront, but what are its implications in terms of our security?
Well, our president and senior policymakers, they have to have intelligence analysts who call things honestly, call them like they see them. They shouldn't be caving their analysis to tell the policymakers what they want to hear or to write analysis to stop policies they disagree with. We need them to call it straight so the policymakers can make a policy. That's their job. Intelligence analysts inform policy. They don't make it.
Fred, one of the most egregious examples of this, which I think you've done as much to chronicle as anybody over the years, was the cooking the books, for want of a better term, by the intelligence community keepers of the national intelligence estimates, namely the one that was done in 2007, as I recall, that suggested that Iran had given up its nuclear weapons ambitions. Would you talk a little bit about that as a sort of case study of this problem of politicized intelligence and how it's translated into the mess that is today's American policy towards Iran and its bomb?
Well, this was an estimate that came out in 2007. That said that Iran had halted its nuclear program in 2003. And this is at a key time when the Bush administration was trying to ramp up efforts to stop Iran's pursuit of nuclear weapons. I was on the House Intelligence Committee at the time, and the intelligence behind this did not add up. It was clearly a politicized estimate, and it was written by two former State Department employees who didn't like Bush administration policy who got jobs in the intelligence community. It was politicization pure and simple, and that's what former CIA Director Jim Schlesinger said. He referred to this as stupid intelligence. He thought it was so awful.
And I think we're still reaping the whirlwind from that, as we are, Fred Flights, from another act of, I think, inappropriate politicization, namely the exploitation of a willing media by this so-called echo chamber that the Obama administration's Ben Rhodes boasted of recently. He's, of course, the deputy national security advisor to the president. Would you talk a little bit about what we've learned of late about all of that and the role played in it by the Plowshares Fund and, well, somebody who reports for the Washington Post?
Well, in a May 2016 New York Times profile, Ben Rhodes, who works for the National Security Council, bragged about how he established a media echo chamber, which he used to manipulate the news media to sell the nuclear deal with Iran. And he admitted that he used false narratives. Well, the recent, and we know that part of this echo chamber was an organization called the Plowshares Fund. This is a liberal organization funded by George Soros, and they were spending millions of dollars to basically buy experts to manipulate the media. Well, recently we found out that a Stanford professor named Alan Weiner wrote an op-ed saying that this $400 million payment, which everyone is calling ransom to free the U.S. prisoners who were being held by Iran, was not ransom, but was in fact the repayment of a U.S. debt to Iran, even though the Justice Department tried to stop this payment because they said it was ransom. This article was taken right out of White House talking points, and I think it is an example, at least of the White House using the echo chamber. And we also know that there are ties between the Plowshares Fund and this Stanford professor. And I think it is really corrupting the political process when an organization like this is buying experts to influence the national debate.
And, of course, this isn't the only example of it. The Plowshares Fund had also put in, by some estimates, between $700,000 and $1 million, I'm told, to essentially gain influence with the national public radio and promote there its experts, its echo chamber, its narratives about this this very dangerous deal with Iran, which you've described as the Obama bomb deal in a very important new book from the Center for Security Policy. And by the way, folks, as with all of our products, I commend to you Fred Fleitz's new book about the national security fraud of this Obama bomb deal, which you can download for free at securefreedom.org. Fred, just in closing, you've described Plowshares Fund as a liberal organization. It seems it's really a radical left one, and we now have had, as a result of an intelligence breakthrough, if you will, this treasure trove of George Soros Foundation emails, proof that the Plowshares Fund got money to suppress critics of the deal with the mainstream media. Can you talk about the kind of impact that campaign seems to have had on the debate, notably on the efforts of our friend Representative Mike Pompeo and others of us who opposed that deal?
I think it had a significant effect on the debate about the Iran deal, because experts were being bought and they weren't revealing that they were receiving payments from this organization to oppose the nuclear deal. And concerning National Public Radio, Congressman Pompeo believes that this money is why conservatives were being kept off the air, but people who support the Iran deal were being featured on National Public Radio. It was a corruption of the public debate over this national security issue.
And I think, as you do, Fred Fleitz materially contributed to the approval, effectively, of this defective Obama bomb deal. Fred, as always, we appreciate your time today and the great work you have done for our country and continue to do now out of the intelligence community at the Center for Security Policy. I hope you'll, of course, keep it up and come back to us again next week. Next up, Daniel Horowitz joins us from Conservative Review. We'll be talking about the suicidal immigration policy we've been pursuing and whether we'll change course before it's too late. That and more straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
America's injured and critically ill service members face incredible challenges every day of their lives. Since 2004, the Semper Fi Fund has helped thousands of service members and their families with both immediate and long-term needs. Join the Semper Fi Fund in supporting American heroes. Learn how your tax-deductible donation makes a real difference in their lives at SemperFiFund.org.
This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. President Obama's wrecking operation, aimed at diminishing our country, emboldening its enemies, and undermining its friends, is moving inexorably forward on a front unknown to most Americans, yet likely to affect many of them personally. Team Obama is determined to end America's effective control over internet domain names by relinquishing to the likes of Russia, China, and Iran the management of ICANN, a bureaucratic mechanism that assigns what amount to website addresses. U.S. government agencies, other users, and internet freedom are sure to suffer. Just one example. If hostile powers can begin assigning to themselves or their friends America's official government and military .gov and .mil domain names, at a minimum, confusion will ensue. More likely, there will be compromises of national security. It's currently against the law to surrender ICANN. Congress must not allow the president to betray his duty again. This is Frank Gaffney.
There are many sounds in your daily life. Ones that make you smile. Ones that help you relax. And there are some sounds that can help save lives. Wireless emergency alerts. Now on many mobile devices, use a unique sound and vibration to bring you critical information about emergencies in your area. With updates from local sources you know and trust, you can be in the know wherever you are. Learn more at ready.gov/alerts. Brought to you by FEMA and the Ad Council.
Secure Freedom announces the launch of our newest initiative, the Counter Jihad Campaign at counterjihad.com. We have gathered some of the foremost experts and activists to begin our fight back against those who long ago declared war on us. You can see our first two ads asking those who see something bad happening, like the attack in Garland, Texas, or the dozen jihadists at the Boston Marathon Killers Mosque, to say something. Join us and be a part of the Counter Jihad.
When we decided to rename this radio station, we came up with one word, one very big word, answer. That's because we know our listeners better than anybody. We know you wake up every day with an insatiable appetite for news and information. But more than that, you want to know what to make of it all. That's why we're here. Do this better than any station in town. Welcome aboard. AM 1260, The Answer.
This is Fred Fleitz with the Center for Security Policy. Now that the June 30th deadline for a nuclear agreement with Iran has passed, Secretary of State John Kerry is in Vienna struggling to finalize an agreement. Listeners to this program know that the nuclear talks are deeply flawed and a bad deal is preordained. We now know one reason for this bad deal is because the Rockefeller Foundation spent millions to back a loose coalition of peace groups, think tanks, and former U.S. officials to push for a nuclear agreement with Iran. This included freelance diplomacy with Iranian officials over the past 10 years. In addition, a core member of this effort is former CIA official Paul Pillar, who wrote a 2012 article titled, "We Can Live with a Nuclear Iran." This explains why a bad deal with Iran will emerge from the nuclear talks. This is another reason why Congress must kill this deal. I'm Fred Fleitz. Learn more at our new website on the Iran talks, irantruth.org.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back. We're joined by Daniel Horowitz, I believe one of the smartest, most thoughtful, most influential young men in America these days, certainly on, well, the right side of the issue. He is a senior editor these days at Conservative Review, an extraordinarily important platform now featuring the great work of Mark Levin as well as Daniels and others. He is the author of The Conservative Consciousness with Daniel Horowitz, also the author of a hugely important new book, Stolen Sovereignty, How to Stop Unelected Judges from Transforming America. Daniel Horowitz, welcome back. It is always a pleasure to have you with us. Thanks so much for your time.
Always great to be with you. Never enough time.
There is never enough time, but let's see what we can do to remedy that in the near future. But for the moment, we've got a glorious 10 minutes, so let's talk about a couple of things. I wanted to visit with you about your analysis of what I think you've quite rightly described as a suicidal immigration policy that we've been pursuing under the Obama administration. Would you characterize why it is suicidal and what on earth we're doing in implementing this policy?
Sure. You know, when it comes to public policy, so many things are abstract. There's a lot of conjecture involved, suppositions, especially on economic theory. But seldom are you blessed with such a vivid illustration in front of your eyes what not to do. And we look ominously across the pond to our European brethren, and we see what Angela Merkel and some of the European leaders have done to destroy their country. their countries, their cultures. You have daily terror attacks there, and it's not a result of, you know, just some immediate kind of policy of bringing over the wrong people. It's a cumulative effect of years, decades worth of supplanting Western civilization with large numbers of Muslim immigrants. And that's the key, the large numbers. There's a lot of debate over a blanket Muslim ban, and I think it's kind of a straw man, because we first need to talk about why are we importing record numbers from the Middle East after we see the failed experiment in Europe. So that was the article, you know, I wrote earlier this week, that 50% of our refugee intake, because we do track refugees by religion, unlike other sectors of immigration, and indeed 50% are Muslim. And, you know, while not all of them are problematic, you guys, Center for Security Policy, commissioned a poll, and you found roughly a third of them do believe in Sharia very fervently, even, you know, jihad in the pursuit of Sharia. There's been a lot of talk about Syrian refugees. We've taken in 10,000. Obama wants to bring in tens of thousands more, but also Somali refugees. Very quietly, Obama has brought in about another 10,000 this fiscal year. And remember, in Minneapolis, we've had similar problems to what the Europeans have had, with a lot of them going on to fight for terror groups, plot terror attacks. So this is suicide embodied through public policy.
Daniel, as I say, you are very thoughtful on these things. And I know that you have given some deliberate thought to the question beyond the violent jihadists, which is an obvious problem. And the fact that the Islamic State and, you know, al-Shabaab and others are using migration as a means of insinuating into this country people who will engage in jihad of the violent kind here. We also have large numbers within that other migration from this community that explicitly embraces Islamic supremacism but may not express it through violence. And I wonder what your thoughts are. Donald Trump referred to this in his speech on Monday as the support networks that are enabling radicalization. I wonder, you know, how important is that to your concern about this suicidal strategy, especially in light of, as you say, a similar kind of phenomenon in Europe?
You know, that really is the dirty little secret no one wants to talk about. When they talk about vetting, everyone likes to say, well, you want to vet out someone who has a membership card to ISIS. Well, you know, few people do. And like I said, this is a long-term problem. Think about many of the attackers, San Bernardino attacker, his family, or the Chattanooga shooter was 2 years old when he was brought over here. So, you know, look, you know, a cute little baby there. There's certainly no way to vet that. The problem is, like you said, the support networks. I have an entire chapter in my book, Stolen Sovereignty. We always talk about our values on immigration. The left likes to talk about that. And I wanted to explore what are our true values. And our true values were this. We would understand that immigration is an elective policy. You know, we got a lot of jerks in our own country, and there's a limit to what you could do about that in a free society, and that's a good thing. But immigration is an elective policy, and our founders, our early political leaders, always believed that given that it's an elective policy, you only want to bring in people of merit, people that will actually enrich the society. You know, Madison, as early as the Constitutional Convention, when they debated this, you know, citizenship laws, they wanted to maintain the character of liberality, which had been, quote, professed in all the constitutions and publications of America. And he wanted to, quote, invite foreigners of merit and Republican principles among us. So, I mean, he was talking about concerns about, you know, aristocrats coming from France and some of these European countries. They could have never envisioned something like Sharia law, which is antithetical to Republican constitutional values. That was, I mean, that is a given that we should all agree that we only want to bring in people that love America, love our people, love our values, and love our Constitution. It is that bedrock. And I think, you know, if Trump really hones in on that message and runs ads to that effect and prosecutes that case against Hillary, that's a very uniting message right there. Because, you know, even Democrats, we might disagree on some policies, but we certainly don't want to bring in, you know, anti-Semitism, you know, the treatment of women, totalitarian views. This is a very uniting view, and it actually is deeply rooted in our history on immigration.
Yeah, and you've made so many really key points there. Daniel, let me close with you by asking about a piece of legislation, speaking about American values, that we're told is a point on which Republicans and Democrats, at least in the Congress, can unite. Much ballyhooed at the moment as an example of uncommon bipartisanship, namely what's called criminal justice reform. You've called it the jailbreak bill. Talk about what this would really result in and its advisability.
Well, they always have these mellifluous sounding names, you know, because they want everyone to think, hey, you know, who opposes reform? Look, the time we live in, this is the absolute worst time to begin reducing sentencing, letting people out of federal prison. Obama, if you've noticed, there's a three-pronged war on our security. There's the foreign policy, national security. There's homeland security with immigration and the borders. And then there's domestically, this domestic insurrection, the rise in crime in major metropolitan areas for the first time in over two decades. This is a very disturbing trend. So the last thing you want to do is become more lenient on some of the mandatory sentencing that actually helped create the two-decade-long improvement, one of the greatest improvements we've ever had in reduction in violent crime. So when they come back in September, naturally Congress has a way of adding gasoline to a fire instead of putting water on it. So they want to pass legislation letting more people out of federal prison. And this is dangerous because Obama has already let out thousands, either directly through commutations or the U.S. Sentencing Commission has reduced sentencing for thousands of violent drug offenders. And as you know, they're not just drugs. They're involved in other violent crimes, ironically, firearms crimes. While Obama goes after law-abiding gun owners, he wants to let violent gun felons out of prison. But then you also have the courts now that are retroactively releasing a number of people. They're redefining cruel and unusual punishment. They're redefining statutes. This is a very disturbing time where, you know, you have all the elements that were there in the 70s. And I know you remember that in the era of violent crime, and we certainly don't want to return to that.
On steroids, I'm afraid, and I think you're absolutely right to raise us the red flag on this one. As you have done incredibly effectively in your new book, Daniel Horowitz, Stolen Sovereignty, How to Stop Unelected Judges from Transforming America. You can also find his writings about how to stop Barack Obama from doing the same as well. Daniel Horowitz of the Conservative Review, thank you so much for your time today and for the superb work you do. I know you will keep it up, and I hope you will come back to us again very soon. Next up, Michael Auslin of the American Enterprise Institute joins us to talk about a provocative new insight he's had into the end of the Asian century, war, stagnation, and the risks to the world's most dynamic region. That and more straight ahead.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
It's been over 7 years since a church group from another state brought a couple hundred refugees to the rural county where I live. I wanted to know, how could they do this? What was the governmental process that allowed the resettlement of refugees to a county ill-prepared to assimilate them? Employment opportunities were scarce. The health department was not familiar with illnesses and mental health problems of people who came from parts of the third world. The school system was not prepared to teach large numbers of students who didn't speak English.
That's author Ann Corcoran discussing her new book, Federal Immigration Policy, Resettlement and the Hijra to America. She explains how Muslim immigrants are being quietly resettled into American towns without vetting them, even for terrorist links. Corcoran also explains how the global jihad movement is using immigration as a stealth campaign to spread its influence in America. You can read Federal Immigration Policy, Resettlement and the Hijra to America on securefreedom.org or purchase a copy on Amazon.com.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real special forces, ours need ammunition. And in the war of ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its special forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
I'm Robert Muse, co-founder and senior counsel of the American Freedom Law Center, our nation's premier public interest law firm fighting for your faith and freedom in courtrooms across America. Make no mistake, we live in a pivotal time. Secular progressives such as Barack Obama and his surrogates are zealously sweeping religion from the public square, foisting Sharia law and other harmful international precedents into our courts and constitution, assaulting the traditional family, and weakening our national defense by, among other things, undermining the strength of our military through social engineering and political correctness. But I can assure you that the American Freedom Law Center is aggressively engaging our nation's enemies with offensive lawfare to defend our fundamental rights and to fight stealth jihad in all of its forms, including the civilization jihad being waged by Muslim Brotherhood front groups operating here in the U.S. Indeed, there is no other public interest law firm as uniquely qualified to fight this battle. But we need your prayers and financial support to succeed. Please consider a tax-deductible donation to support our critical fight for your faith and freedom. Visit us at www.AmericanFreedomLawCenter.org.
I'm Fred Fleitz with the Center for Security Policy. One of President Obama's worst foreign policy failings is the lack of a strategy to defeat Al-Qaeda and ISIS. These terrorist groups are part of a global movement to establish Islamic supremacy and Sharia through violence. This movement is called the Global Jihad Movement. It will not be defeated without a strategy that recognizes its true nature. In January 2015, we issued a comprehensive strategy to defeat the global jihad movement. It is called the Secure Freedom Strategy and is based on National Security Directive 75, the strategy that President Ronald Reagan used to defeat the global totalitarian threat of his time, the Soviet Union. Like President Reagan's strategy, we lay out a comprehensive plan on how the United States government can be reorganized and focused to understand and defeat the global jihad movement. You can read the Secure Freedom Strategy at securefreedom.org, or you can purchase a copy on Amazon.com. I'm Fred Fleitz.
This is Jenny Thomas. I do video interviews of leaders with the Daily Caller. I had the privilege recently of interviewing Diana West about her extraordinary new book, American Betrayal, The Secret Assault on Our Nation's Character. You can see it at dailycaller.com. American Betrayal reads like a spellbinding historical thriller, but it is also a carefully documented account of how the U.S. government was penetrated by communist agents in the years after President Roosevelt normalized relations with the Soviet Union. Diana West shows how a similar assault is being mounted today by yet another collectivist ideology, the supremacist Islamic doctrine of Sharia. She establishes that while the communists and the Islamists may have very different visions of the world, they have employed the same techniques to defeat America. Please watch my conversation with Diana West about American Betrayal, then check out the other great leaders we profile at dailycaller.com.
Annie Soldier Incorporated was started in August 2003 as a simple family effort to help the soldiers in one Army unit, thus the name. However, due to overwhelming requests, on January 1, 2004, the Annie Soldier effort was expanded so it would include any member of any of the armed services in harm's way. Won't you please help? Find out how by going to www.anysoldier.com today.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. Our guest for this segment is Dr. Michael Auslan, a highly regarded scholar and professor and expert on a very important part of the world, Asia. He is a contributor through his role as a resident scholar and director of Japan Studies at the American Enterprise Institute, a biweekly columnist for the Wall Street Journal, an author in a prodigious way of both periodical literature and, of course, several important books.
Hello, Frank. Thanks for having me.
Let's talk about your thoughts, particularly, Michael, about the very serious danger, it seems to me, that is emerging at the moment in this Western Pacific, East Asia region of conflict. perhaps with the Chinese and us, perhaps with the Chinese and others, who knows, the North Koreans. Give us your read on the prospects as you see them.
Well, I think, first of all, this is an easy region to overlook. I mean, we've got major problems in the Middle East, obviously, that are only growing. We have continued problems in Europe with Russia. We've got to focus on the U.S. election here. And so the fact that Asia is not erupting into conflict today is something that allows people to sort of kick it to the side and say, well, you know, we'll deal with it later. The problem is that it's not static. And as we've seen over the past several years, China has militarized the South China Sea. It has built new islands in those seas. It has essentially declared that it is going to begin enforcing its claims, and that's down in the south. It is challenging Japan in the East China Sea. And as you mentioned, North Korea, continuing to do what North Korea does best, which is keep everyone on edge in the north. We are really at a point where Asia could flare into conflict, and we will be caught by surprise, not because we haven't known that there are problems, but because we're not paying attention to them. And I think the danger is growing.
Not paying attention to them is, of course, just one piece of it. I think this indictment would also go further to say we're not preparing for it, as in fact we should. Let me ask you about a thesis that he has advanced, and I suspect it's part of your analysis as well, Michael, and that is that China is really facing a kind of demographic time bomb with its one-child policy. And these are my words, not his, but I think it captures the thought that China's got to get while the getting's good. And that's why we're seeing it behaving so aggressively in the South China Sea before it suddenly confronts the reality that its population is going to contract and thereby reduce its ability to have its way elsewhere in the region. Do you read it that way as well?
I certainly think that's part of the problems that China faces. I think what we have not gotten our heads around, and it's certainly something that I try to talk about extensively in the book that you mentioned, The End of the Asian Century, is that China faces a raft of problems. And our narrative, our sort of cultural mindset on China has been one of fear and opportunism at the same time, thinking it was just going to grow forever and we could turn it into some sort of natural political partner of ours as well as the world's largest economy. And the reality is the future for China is rather bleak. It is going to face a huge number of economic, political, demographic, as you mentioned, social problems. And part of it is that the disastrous one-child policy for 30 years, which has just been overturned, is going to send it into a demographic decline, which is going to put social stress, which is going to cause political stress, and exacerbate the economic weakness that people are just beginning to take acknowledgement of.
Yeah. And as you look at this, the economic piece of it particularly, you talk about stagnation. There has been a remarkable phenomenon. I think it used to be said when the United States sneezes, the world catches cold. It seems as though at the moment when China has stagnation, the rest of the world is catching a kind of economic pneumonia. Is that overstating it? And if not, what are the repercussions of that kind of stagnation, Michael Osler?
No. This is a huge issue, Frank. And, you know, it sort of gets into specifics that a lot of people don't pay attention to. But first, what finally woke people up was when the Chinese stock market cratered last year, which sent global stock markets and global equities sharply down. And then it happened again at the beginning of this year. The bloom has come off the rose of this idea that, you know, China is a sort of Marco Polo land of eternal growth. And so the instability and uncertainty that is coming from the weakness in the economy reflected in China's stock market, the multi-$100 billion capital outflow that the Communist Party is trying to staunch, the outflow from China, which is further weakening prospects for growth in the country, is also combined with the fact that its slowdown, which has been going on now for several years, and which the Chinese leadership is telling us is no mere blip, but is the new normal, has depressed economic growth throughout Asia, as well as even farther abroad in the world, but particularly in Asia, the economies of Japan, South Korea, Australia, so developed and less developed economies as well, have been hurt by the Chinese contagion. Now, you know, you talk to folks who invest and who trade, and they're still working on the old model of China, and they're so invested in it that it's very hard for them
to acknowledge this new reality. And what they'll say is, well, you know what? If China's growing at 5%, that's better than anywhere else. But of course, what we're talking about is probably stagnation that's happening right now, and a drop, a significant drop from 10% growth and more to barely limping along. So the big story in the next decade will be the end of the China dream and how the world is going to react to a China that's come down to earth. In some ways, that's good. In some ways, it'll actually cause more problems.
Yeah. Michael Osland, are you concerned that the Chinese are cooking the books on the numbers and that they may, in some respects, be even worse than what we're being told at the moment?
Oh, I think most serious analysts and economists, and here you need to do a little bit of old-fashioned Kremlinology, you know, you have to combine politics and economics, are pretty much convinced of that proposition. And it's more complex, I think, in a way. I'm not sure that Beijing, and I don't think anyone's really sure that Beijing is blatantly cooking the books. It's that the whole system is corrupt. And so no one really knows what the true growth level is or true growth rates. You had just a few weeks ago, I think about a month or two ago, the central government sanction and actually punish the Central Statistics Bureau, which is one of its own bureaus, for rampant misrepresentation of statistics. Now, were they doing it on their own, or were they getting bad statistics from the interior? And the answer is probably yes to all of those. So the reality is that no one, I think even the Chinese, understand exactly what's going on with the economy. You have to disaggregate it by sector, disaggregate it by region. The Northeast clearly seems to be in a stagnant, if not recessionary, phase. There's still some growth along the coast, but here's the real issue, I think, for us. We have become fairly good and certainly put a lot of time over the past quarter century into developing tools to understand what a growing and stronger China looks like. We now have to develop a different set of tools to understand what a weakening and less powerful China looks like.
I couldn't have said it better. And let me just ask you one last question before we let you go that, of course, is interconnected in so many ways with what we've just been discussing, and that is the prospect that the Japanese and or the South Koreans may be looking at this evolving situation and the risks associated with it and saying, you know, we better get ourselves a nuclear deterrent of our own, especially since we can't have confidence in that of the United States any longer. Your quick thoughts on that, Michael Osland?
It's a third rail for Japan. There are obviously some strategists who think about it in general. I don't think the country is anywhere near that yet. It would be a huge failure of American policy if they got to that point. I think we should really keep our eyes on South Korea. The South Koreans have made it very clear how disappointed they are and frustrated they are with our unwillingness to do anything about North Korea, which is becoming a full-fledged nuclear power, and it is now an open topic of debate. Now, if they do go nuclear, then it will be added pressure on Japan to talk about the possibility of this. So I think that our inaction, our lack of a strategy, may actually force some of our allies to take the unthinkable step of becoming nuclear powers, and that would have a reverberation effect throughout the region.
Michael, I hope you'll come back to us again soon, and the rest of you will do the same tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.